Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity is back. He, of course, from National Review and author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for us as usual. And, Jim, it's always a doubly good martini when it's not only good news for conservatives, but the story was actually done by National Review. Eliana Johnson, in this case, who sometimes fills in for Jim when he's away, she came into possession of what appears to be a document from the Michelle Nunn for Senate campaign in Georgia that was not meant to get outside the Michelle Nunn for Senate campaign in Georgia. But it's quite clear, quite honest in what they think of her shortcomings. They call her potentially accused of being a lightweight, too liberal, not a real Georgian. She grew up while her dad was in the Senate, so she grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. They basically explain how they're going to divide all the different groups in order to cobble together a coalition because they have no intention of actually trying to win the white vote. They think gays are good for money. They think that they can get Asians to get on board. They got to watch out for those donations from the Points of Light Foundation to groups that could be considered terrorists due to their connection to Hamas and others. So, Jim, other than that, a really good day for the Nunn campaign.
Yeah, I mean, you could kind of admire the honesty in it, you know, except that it was never meant to be shared with the public at large. The not-so-subtle theme of this, by the way, some fantastic reporting by Eliana Johnson, who deserves every attagirl she's going to get this week and for the next week as well. The message here is that this is really a terrible candidate who doesn't have roots in the state, has viewpoints that are far out of it. And I think there's kind of just, there were some folks I saw, I think it was Nick Cafasori of the New York Times saying, you know, isn't this kind of standard for a campaign? But he's not dismissing it, he insisted. Well, very rarely do you see it written down in black and white with such clarity that they basically see all of these little constituent groups as groups to be sucked money out of, including the one that was perhaps the most fascinating was Jews. The amount of money we can raise from Jews is dependent upon how strong our stance on Israel is. Oh, by the way, Israel's stance, TBT, to be determined, meaning that Michelle Nunn doesn't even really know what she thinks of this. But if there's a lot of money in it, she'll back Israel. It strikes me as, you know, like as a pro-Israel guy, that's not really why you're supposed to do things. I'm very little in this about, you know, who Michelle Nunn really is. Like who she is basically something that has to be hid from the electorate instead of revealed or showcased. No one was expecting Michelle Nunn to come across and be this fantastic candidate for the Democrats. Although they thought she was probably the strongest candidate they could get and maybe she had an outside shot. You'd like to think this would undo it. And basically say, no, this woman is a joke. She really shouldn't be running for office, particularly when you have to hide so much of your background, including the fact that, oh, by the way, you've been running a charity, and that charity just happened to give some money to groups that are close to Hamas, because really, this is not a good moment to be associated with Hamas in the public's mind, I would argue. Not that there's really that many good times, but this is a particularly bad time. Yeah.
And there aren't that many Republican-held seats that Democrats think they even have a legitimate shot at. This would probably be one of two, the other being Kentucky. And so at a time when, you know, you'd think Michelle Nunn would be trying to capitalize on the divisiveness of the Republican campaign, which had so many candidates and then a pretty bitter runoff, this is about as good of a outcome coming out of that runoff that David Perdue could have hoped.
What's fantastic is every criticism he can make from here on out. When she says, oh, the same old negative. No, no. This is from your own campaign, Michelle. You know, this is the politics equivalent of something Big Brothers used to do to Little Brothers. Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? You know, being able to cite, you know, your opponent's campaign and all the things that are so wrong about her. What you're going to say? It's all lies. My campaign was making up these nasty things about me. You know, it's interesting. You almost wonder if the Nunn campaign ought to close up shop and if she wants to be in politics, try some other time because, you know, it just kind of showcased all the weaknesses from soup to nuts. And there's just, you know, a lot there, a target-rich environment, as political consultants would say.
Yesterday, of course, our bad martini was the Middle East, and particularly John Kerry's role as Secretary of State in offering a ceasefire that offered pretty much everything Hamas wanted, virtually nothing Israel wanted, and of course, it was roundly rejected by the Israeli Security Cabinet. We mentioned in passing that the crisis between Israel and Hamas kind of overshadowed another major bad martini over the weekend, the U.S. evacuating the embassy in Tripoli, Libya. And that's because fighting and massive fires are raging very close to that facility. So, Jim, I guess the slight good martini is that This time they actually realized the threat to their diplomatic position and got people out of there. The bad news is that less than 3 years after deposing Muammar Gaddafi, Libya is as much of a disaster as you could have imagined.
Saturday morning, getting the emailed message from the Pentagon announcing this, and I suppose we should give molecules of credit to the administration for avoiding another Benghazi-type situation. The indications were that the situation in Tripoli, not just Benghazi, but now Tripoli, the national capital, was unsafe for our people, and they got them out of there. There was a little bit of, you know, the cable news after that, and somebody was giving the State Department spokesperson grief, and my sense is, look, as much as we'd like to have fantastic relations with the new Libyan government, to the extent that there still is a new Libyan government, it's not worth watching our people die. So I don't begrudge the State Department this move for caution at all. Having said that, I don't think there's any way to dispute the fact that Libya is an absolute mess, and what has replaced Gaddafi is not anything resembling a stable pro-Western or even just a decent regime, but just flat-out anarchy and warlords and various factions shooting the hell out of each other. It says something that Libya, we can do that. We can evacuate every last American diplomatic staff out of a country. It happens over a weekend, and by Monday, almost no one's talking about it because the rest of the world is in such chaos. Remember, this was one of the triumphs of intervention of the first term of Barack Obama's presidency. This is one of the triumphs of Hillary Clinton's term. And I think we can look at this and say, look, leading from behind did not get us anywhere, and we now live in a much more dangerous world. And it's such a dangerous world. This isn't even a small brush fire. This is a major brush fire that just pales in comparison to the messes in Russia and Ukraine, what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Israel, and maybe ISIS in Iraq, and maybe Syria. And oh, by the way, there's an Ebola outbreak. So other than that, the world is stable and at peace. So that's the next thing that's going to push everything off the front page is, you know, God forbid one of these folks with Ebola gets on a plane and comes to the U.S.
All right. On to the previous Secretary of State, who was, of course, doing such a fabulous job as it related to Libya back during her 4 years in office, that being Hillary Clinton. She, of course, fresh off her less than successful book tour. And now she's still doing some interviews and helping to position herself potentially for a 2016 White House run. She was talking with Jorge Ramos of Fusion, and the issue, obviously, of the current Middle East fighting between Israel and Hamas came up. Hillary Clinton talking about her desire to see an end to the bloodshed, admitting that Hamas instigated this, but just heartbroken over the images coming out of Gaza. And here's the follow-up from Ramos and Clinton's response.
And what's the appropriate response, you think?
Well, I think what the problem is, and this is something, I'm not a military planner, sure, but Hamas puts its missiles, its rockets in civilian areas. Part of it is that Gaza is pretty small and it's very densely populated. They put their command and control of Hamas military leaders in those civilian areas. Israel, I know, has sent warnings and tried to get people to move. But in any kind of conflict, there are going to be civilian casualties, and we need to try to get to a ceasefire as soon as possible.
Jim, you just moved out of a smaller house into a larger house. If you are going to have weapons that could potentially kill a lot of people and present a military target, you would have had no choice but to keep them near your children's rooms.
I said I'm thinking of some sort of Liebestrom reference and that Hamas needs breathing room. Is it astonishingly dumb statement from allegedly a smart woman? And I'm sure by the time 2016 rolls around, we'll be told she's the smartest woman ever run for president. Is Gaza Strip relatively small? Sure. Is it densely populated? Sure. There's no other place to put these missiles. So let's put them in the school. You know, look, this is all a matter of prioritization of Hamas. I mean, you know, keep in mind that they've built this giant network of tunnels that they're using to try to go over to Israel and to, you know, burrow in under the ground and attack them from sneak attacks from there. You know, tunnels would make a really great way to protect your people from incoming missiles if they wanted it. But they don't, you know. If they wanted to build areas, you know, where they could put civilians, they could put kids that weren't near missiles, they could do that. And if they wanted to have, you know, secure depots where they could keep all of their weapons, they could do that too. They have the money. We're giving them foreign aid. But it's a very deliberate strategy by Hamas. And it's kind of striking to see Hillary not calling it out and kind of saying, look, they've got no choice. There's just not enough room. They really need, you know, more territory so they can find another place to store their missiles. I mean, it's kind of, you know, like she's speaking off the cuff, but there's such moral depravity in that assessment and cloddishness that I'm kind of surprised it hasn't blown up bigger. So I suppose this is our effort to call people's attention to just an astonishingly wrongheaded statement by our former Secretary of State.
We've done three martinis. One quick champagne toast. Jim, we've mentioned the movie Die Hard many, many times in this podcast. In fact, just last week, as a result of Jonathan Gruber and his approach to Obamacare, Jim made the reference to Hans Gruber from Die Hard and Simon Peter in the third installment of the Die Hard series. In an actual true story, the man who played Mr. Takagi, the president of the Nakatomi Corporation, or at least the head of the Los Angeles office in the original movie, passed away at the age of 81 yesterday. In addition to his great acting, he was also a former Marine and a Korean War veteran. So Jim, as diehard fans of this movie,
there we go. Yeah,
a tribute to him on a great service to our country and a great job in that great movie.
I'm a little bit surprised you haven't played the sound clip that he won't be able to join us for the rest of his life. It seems like a life well led and some wonderful performances. So wishing his family well as they mourn him, and he will live forever in celluloid in that infamous moment and great scenes and such. So, you know, farewell to him and the many happy memories he's brought us.
Absolutely. And he wore a fabulous suit, as Hans pointed out. Jim, have a great day.
Have a great day, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Wednesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.